Hello and welcome to Table Talk, the Spectator's food and drink podcast. I'm Lara Prendergast.
And I'm Olivia Potts.
And today we're delighted to be joined by Ella Alshamahi. Ella is an explorer, paleoanthropologist, evolutionary biologist who specialises in the study of Neanderthals and a stand-up comic. Her first book, The Handshake, is out now. Ella, welcome to Table Talk.
Thank you for having me.
Ella, we're going to start where we always do, at the beginning, and ask you, what are your earliest memories of food?
Oh my gosh. I remember my nan telling me my eyes were bigger than my belly. And do you know what? I still have that problem. So I would say I remember people telling me to stop scoffing. It was definitely something. Snorting, I think, is probably more accurate. And I remember also being really exposed to Yemeni food very, very early on, obviously, because my parents are Yemeni. But also English food, because my nana, of eyes are too big for your belly fame, is white from Liverpool. So I kind of got, you know, I don't know if we have any people that are familiar with Yemeni cuisine, but like helba next to a shepherd's pie.
And what's a helba for people who aren't familiar?
A helba is, so you know fenugreek? So fenugreek, which most people don't even know about, it's like a herb. Guess and it's not a spice, I think it's a herb. You basically put it in water and then you froth it, and it becomes like a proper thick froth, and you add it to a meat stock. And the meat stock is essentially boiling in a clay pot, and then you add the fenugreek on top, and you have some meat in there, and then you use bread, and you kind of, it's like a communal thing, and it is, I cannot tell you how much of an acquired taste it is, and yet how absolutely delicious it is.
Sounds really good. I've never even heard of it.
No, I have to take you one day. There's only one or two Yemeni restaurants in London. I'll drag you guys there one day.
And what are the other kind of classic Yemeni dishes?
There's what I call the volcano. Sorry. As somebody who studies mountains and kind of caves and all the rest of it, the fact that one of my foods is literally shaped like a volcano is not lost on me. So it's like a paste. It's almost like a dumpling paste you shape it into the shape of a volcano. And instead of kind of lava in the center, again, you get meat broth and you kind of condense it down till it's really, really thick. And you add a lot of, I guess for this particular dish, they have onions that are brought to the point of bitter almost. They're cooked to the point of bitter and they add that to the meat broth. And so that meat broth then goes in the middle of the volcano and you get two fingers, or if you're me and you're way too English, you get a spoon. but you get two fingers or the spoon, you kind of take a bit out the side of the mountain and then you kind of dunk it into the middle of the lava, the kind of the volcano-y bit in the middle, and you put it in your mouth and it's so heavy, I cannot tell you. But that is not an acquired taste and it goes down a real treat.
And so it's a sort of a communal dish that everyone tears away at.
Yeah. Yemenis, I think Arabs generally are quite big on communal dishes, but it's really funny because we've had other Arabs, not even kind of people not from the region, but just not from Yemen, try the helba, the fenugreek dish, and kind of want to kind of throw up because they've just been like, oh my God, that was really weird. And some have been really addicted to it. But that volcano dish, that's kind of loved universally, I think. It's just super heavy. So when you eat it, you're like, okay, that's going to be me done for a few weeks now.
With an emphasis on communal dining within your culture, were mealtimes important to your family as a child?
Yeah, very, very much so. And they were kind of a complete ordeal. So one of the things we learned much later on in life through hanging out with our kind of, you know, just school friends was that, you know, on average, in the average kind of, you know, English household or British household, there's just one course or like sometimes two for, you know, for dinner. You're not sitting there with loads of things on the table. So we'd like go to a friend's house once every so often, we'd come back going like, what's wrong with them? And because my nan, being white, but had become so acclimatised to the Arabs, so to speak, that she was, you know, just like the rest of the family, and kind of would put a million things on the table. So I think, yeah, one of the things was just the amount of food on those tables was insane. and completely impractical. Like, I couldn't do that now. I eat out now constantly. I can't.
And what sorts of dishes would it be? A kind of mixture of Yemeni and kind of classic British cuisine, or was it?
Yeah,
or the other.
That's exactly it. So it was a lot of Yemeni food, and then there was kind of the odd English dish kind of thrown in there as well. We were really big fans. This is going to sound really funny, but just like, there's a complete juxtaposition, because sometimes I'm just saying out loud and I'm like, yeah, maybe I shouldn't say this out loud because it doesn't go, but like really kind of classic rice kind of meaty dishes that are Arab next to just like a cheese pie, just like potato and cheese on top. Really standard, and it was like, this is really yum, and that doesn't really go together, I can see, in adulthood, but yeah.
And who was the cook in your house? Was your mother the cook, your father?
No, my mother for sure, and my nan would also kind of throw in some stuff as well, but it was mostly my mum. Yeah.
And did she teach you to cook?
She, you know, for a really long time, she was very disappointed with how undomesticated all her daughters were. I think it's so funny because, guys, I'm not just saying this, I'm really domesticated. I am. Like, I know how to clean stuff and I know how to cook stuff and blah, blah, blah. But to an immigrant mother who's Yemeni, I was just a disappointment in that regard. Because I don't know, I couldn't do it blindfolded or something. I have no idea. But yeah, she definitely got us in the kitchen and cooking a lot. And then I had an arranged marriage. So kind of, you know, I kind of maintained some traditional kind of stuff. And then obviously got divorced and now refuse to go into the kitchen. And like genuinely, I could tell you what I have cooked for the last 3 months because it would have been that little. And there will be things like omelettes. That's the extent of my cooking now.
And so during your arranged marriage, were you expected to cook? Was that the sort of role that you were expected to play?
Okay, honestly, I think I was, but I didn't. I think I was. But bless my ex-mother-in-law, is a wonderful human being. She would just cook a lot for us as well. That was just the easiest thing to do, was just to get her food. But also, I think my ex-husband didn't always like my food, and I didn't always take that well. So I remember once having cooked her, this is quite amusing, I cooked a, it was something ridiculous, it was something like a 12-course meal for Christmas. It was ridiculous. It was maybe 15, I don't know, it was proper. I mean, there was like vine leaves covering, quail covered in vine leaves and all kinds of like fantastic stuff. And at the end I was like, so what did you like? And he was like, oh, I don't know really. And I was like, right, well, with that attitude, you're not getting food for 6 months. I just refused to go into the kitchen for 6 months. So maybe it's a surprise, isn't it, guys, that marriage didn't work.
And taking you back, what was school food like when you were growing up? It was Birmingham that you lived in, is that right?
I loved school food. I never understood the thing about school food not being great. I actually really liked it. My sisters and I have actually gone off to try to find a chocolate concrete recipe with custard. I don't know if you guys remember that.
Was it like a milkshake of chocolate concrete?
No, it was. I think it was just Birmingham schools, because we've spoken to people in non-Brummy schools and they have no idea what we're talking about. And this is the problem, is when I describe it to people. But my sister was in a private school and she had the same thing as well. So I don't even think it was I think it was a Birmingham thing, because we were in state schools. It's a chocolate cake that's so hard you could like bang it, hence chocolate concrete. Do you guys know what I'm talking about? it's a Brummy thing.
Exactly, yes, but I don't know about that name.
This was like very regular in Brummy schools. And you kind of, yeah, and then they'd add hot custard to it and you'd turn it into the most delicious thing. And yeah.
Have you ever tried to recreate this?
No, we've tried to look for recipes and everything and we can't seem to, it's just a Birmingham thing. And I don't think it's a Birmingham thing anymore either. I think it was just for when we were growing up in the 80s and 90s. That existed, but otherwise I was a really big fan of you know, the food in my school. And it, you know, as I said, it was a grammar school, there's nothing special about it. It was good food. And the other thing is, because my nan sometimes worked in a school as the chef, sometimes she'd bring, like, as a cook rather, she'd bring some stuff home sometimes. I'd love it, no complaints.
Sounds
from me.
Sounds great. And what about when you went to university, what was food like at that point?
So the first year I lived in college, first 2 years, I think, I lived in College Hall, which is, for those kind of familiar with London, it's like slap bang in the middle of Mallet Street. So it's very much in the centre of Bloomsbury. So it's kind of a wonderful location. So I was expecting this fantastic food. And our dorms was catered. I remember once trying to speak to the... Oh, this makes me sound terrible. I tried speaking to the cook because I was like, look, your vegetarian spaghetti kind of...
you know, kind of sauce that you put on has celery in it. And I just don't think celery belongs with tomatoes and in a cooked... I just don't think celery should ever be cooked. And I think she was just like, who is this 18-year-old? I don't know if I'm allowed to swear on your podcast, but yeah. She was not... They're just looking at me like, who are you? It's like, what?
And at university in London, were you able to take advantage of the food around you? Or I feel like sometimes during student days, that kind of whooshes over your head. It did during mine.
No, I was hooked up on food, like properly. So one of the things was that I was really big on shawarma. So shawarma sandwiches, like the kebabs, but they're more Lebanese. So they make the standard kind of corner shop kebab. It's like the gourmet version, I guess, is the best way of putting it. So I turned up to Edgware Road. And coming from Birmingham at the time, where there was quite a significant Arab community, but we didn't have the restaurants, the cuisine in those kind of restaurants. Turning up to Edgware Road and being like, oh my God, I have arrived. These are my people. Like, there is so much of my people's food here. And the food that was so difficult to get in Birmingham, like, my mum's not going to sit there making shawarma kebabs. Do you know what I mean? Like, who's got the time to do that? There was this one joint where they knew me so well that I would just walk in, they would look at me and in Arabic say, lamb without parsley and without onions. And I was like, hell yes. And then I was like, after a while, I was like, this is actually a little bit embarrassing, isn't it?
And to move things on slightly, tell us about your kind of how you became an explorer. I mean, that sort of sounds like the dream job. And in 2015, you were named a National Geographic Emerging Explorer. What does that entail? And what have you eaten on your explorations?
I know. So I mean, that was a really... That is still, like, one of the biggest honours that you could get. I don't know about you guys, but I was brought up with kind of those yellow magazines in the corner, and I just never imagined... I legitimately never imagined people were still doing this kind of thing. I certainly didn't imagine anyone other than kind of, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with old white men, but I just never imagined anyone other than kind of really bearded old white men from the 1900s doing this. So, like, some brown girl from Birmingham was a real surprise to me. So I think, yeah, it was a massive honour. And it just, all it really means is that I do a lot of field work. That's really all it means. And in fact, it's kind of quite a fantastic title. I quite like using it, though, because I think it's kind of conjures up certain things in your head, and that kind of makes me smile. I would like to point out, though, that I regularly get told by my friends, who I love, that Google Earth has kind of made me redundant, has made my whole job description redundant. And I'm like, thanks, guys, can we not discuss this? But yeah, and you know, obviously those travels are kind of, you know, they're wonderful. You get to meet so many cultures and different ways of thinking. And yes, food, like, just so much food in its natural habitat, as opposed to kind of, you know, and we're so lucky in our cities in the UK that we have so much incredible cuisine. But to kind of see it in its actual place in situ is like something else.
And what have you tried?
What haven't I tried at this point? No, legitimately, like, you know, the places in the world that I've been to, certainly, you know, because we've spent so much time there, I've definitely, with my teams, sorry, I'm not just using the royal we just for the sake of it. I was in the Amazon quite a bit in 2019 filming for a Channel 4 thing. And that food, I think, of all the food that I've had recently, was quite a surprise to me. Then there was some African cuisine as well that turned out to be a bit of a surprise. But I think it was the Amazonian cuisine that was such a surprise, just also because of the way it's packaged.
Mm. And what sort of thing is it?
Yeah, so, well, they really like manioc out there. So that's kind of, I guess potatoes come from the Americas or the New World. Mm. And so they're really into their roots. So it's kind of a similar thing, but it's more popular in kind of the regions where I was. And one of the things that they do is, and I didn't know this at the time, manioc can be highly poisonous. So they actually have this device and they kind of sift it through the device so that all the poisonous bits stay behind in the sieve and what kind of comes out is okay to eat. And I'm not the biggest fan of that, but one of the things that I absolutely was just going crazy for was rice with chicken, just flavoured brilliantly, but packaged in banana leaves. And so we'd be going on these, you know, kind of longer treks or whatever, and we'd be asking, you know, for our food to be packaged, just expecting it to be dumped into plastic or whatever. Mm. And it'd be put into these incredible kind of
packages of banana leaves. And it added to it. And I have no idea if it added to it because it, you know, it preserved the temperature in a particular way, or if it was because the flavours were kind of, I have no idea. But, or it might be psychosomatic, it just felt so exotic. I have no idea. But I remember just losing it, like on one boat in the middle of one of the rivers, just being like, this food is insane. And I can just throw the, you know, throw the plastic in inverted commas overboard and not be, you know, in any way guilty about it. But yeah, it's kind of, it's one of those things, that particular meal's really stuck with me. Like, I remember trying to extend that bit of the expedition. Like, not for discovery. No, just because the food was that good. But yeah, and that's kind of, you know, it's kind of always great to just sample kind of the fish and the different things around the world. And you know, to try and be polite as well is something that I find quite difficult, partly because I'm a comic and I guess sometimes an asshole. I was with one group in the Amazon and they provided me with turtle. And I was not a fan of that. Like, I had, and the thing is, I couldn't hide it.
You just didn't like the taste? It was the gross. Kind of concept of it.
It was
really?
Truly,
what does
yeah,
turtle taste
slimy.
Like?
It was really slimy. It was, just felt very wrong. It was a texture that I wasn't used to and didn't want to get used to, put it like that. And yeah, I had to, it was actually a case where the AP, bless her, we looked at each other afterwards and she was like, we should probably redo that take, right? And I was like, yeah. We should.
So you being filmed eating it?
Yeah.
That must be quite awkward to be feeling.
Yeah, it was just a bit too rude. I think the way I was like, that was, and I think you just, especially in front of people who've just cooked for you, I was like, that wasn't cool of me. It wasn't, you know, anyway intentional. It was just so gross, guys. Just really rank. And you know, the other food that they had on the table was amazing, but that was just, it was just super weird.
So how had they done it? They just sort of boiled it or?
Well, actually it's really interesting because this is quite a modern phenomenon that we don't eat turtle anymore. So like Neanderthals ate turtle. And actually I've worked on Neanderthal sites where it just looks like they were using turtle shells like pot noodles. They'd just find a turtle, they'd flip it upside down, put it on the stove or the, you know, the fire, and kind of just, you know, kind of scoop it all up. And actually I've been to Yemen where I was on a beach where there's a whole pile of endangered sea turtles and we could see in the distance some people cooking and eating them. So it is a thing that is eaten by people. And actually, if you read some of the old resources, like the old writings about the Americas and the Amazon, they do refer to almost like factory farming turtles. So they'd kind of put them all on these long sticks kind of and just have loads of them as food kind of that they could just easily transport around and stuff. So there's documentation of this for a really, really long time. I just don't like it.
Fair enough.
It was super weird to me. And you know, it was kind of interesting because I think I had a real awakening out there with food because I try not to eat beef just because of, you know, kind of I try to be very responsible about the beef I eat. So I you know, I kind of have a few steaks here and there and I try to make sure that they're, you know, like at restaurants which are well sourced and stuff, just for environmental reasons. And I remember making this decision before I went to the Amazon. I was like, I'm going to really try because I've, you know, I'm useless at being a vegetarian. I'm going to at least try to eat less beef. And then I turn up to the Amazon and it was, guys, it was horrible. like it was, on one side, you'd be literally seeing the Amazon burn, like actually burning. You know, we were constantly going past these illegal fires and you'd just be like, oh my God, we're literally burning the lungs of our planet. This is insane. And then for lunch, for dinner, I'm surprised they didn't give it to us for breakfast. They would bring along, and I cannot tell you, it was like intoxicating meat. It was so good. I have never tasted beef like that. It was just, I mean, you guys know what kind of restaurants, the beef restaurants in that region are like. They kind of walk around and the beef is kind of on these skewers kind of, and they just kind of keep dumping it on your plate. And I just sit there crying because I was supposed to not be eating this. And it was like the most flawed human that you could sit, like this presenter who is, you know, sitting there acutely like cut up about what's going on in the Amazon and just absolutely like this meat is next level. I don't know how And you're suddenly like, well, no wonder you guys are eating so much of it. It's way too good. Obviously, that's not an excuse. And it was really funny because the rest of the team were just looking at me like I was truly pathetic. You know, one of them was a vegetarian, but the others were not vegetarians, but they also weren't going off on one, I think. And I think they were just looking at me and the internal conflict and just the honesty of my internal conflict. And they were just like, you're really pathetic, dude. Like,
so you mentioned the Neanderthals before when you were talking about turtles. That's the area of focus of your PhD at the moment. Where did that interest come from for you?
I think I, like a lot of people, are just really, really fascinated in where we come from and who we are. And Neanderthals, till now, are the relative that we know the most about. And probably our closest relative, although there are, you know, possible others as well. But and so it's just, you know, it's a question of what makes us Homo sapiens. And I was always obsessed with it. You know, I was just like, why are we the only ones left? And I don't think people realize this, but this is the first time in human history that only one species of human has walked this earth. Like, it was a proper Lord of the Rings scenario. Mm. And I know, right? and it's the first time. And you just think, why? Like, why are we the only ones left? Is there something special about us? Is there something not special? Is there something terrible about us, you know, that we're the only ones left? We've made it so intolerable for everyone else, or worse. So that's kind of, I think, my fascination with Neanderthals. It's really about my fascination with us. So basically, I'm a narcissist, I think, is what I'm getting at.
And tell us, you mentioned the turtles earlier, tell us about the kind of Neanderthal diet and sort of what you've discovered about it.
So actually, it's not even what I've discovered. It's what a lot of researchers have kind of been uncovering, all this stuff, particularly in recent years, about Neanderthal diet, which is kind of spectacular. Because I think there's the stereotype of Neanderthals having eaten, I don't know, like mammoths, you know, and just kind of big game, and that's pretty much, you know, the extent of it. And it turns out Neanderthals were like us. They manipulated their environment. They had local cuisine. So not all Neanderthals, because, you know, Neanderthals ranged from Britain, you know, to Spain, to God knows where. And they had variable diets, like, you know, kind of cultures and stuff. The ones that were near the sea would eat seafood and were quite smart in how they manipulated probably netting and what have you to get seafood. Others were eating, you know, meat. Others were possibly eating not just vegetables, but possibly also, so this is quite cool actually, the green in the intestines of animals. I like how your eyes are doing something interesting. But no, as in they were eating every bit of the animal, which makes sense because, you know, food was going to be hard to get, so you weren't going to throw stuff away. Mm. You know, I look at the way I eat meat and it's not the best way of eating meat. You know, I eat the best cuts and that's it. Well, where's the rest of it going, you know? So it is really interesting. And it's also, I guess it's one of my big problems with the way people think about the paleo diet, is that it's based on a lot of pseudoscience as opposed to actual science. Because the real paleo diet wouldn't have looked like that, if that makes sense.
So what are the kind of classic components of the paleo diet? And what's the real paleo diet?
I did a show about Neanderthals. So the very, very first TV series I did was about Neanderthals. And I managed to convince the team to let me turn up to a paleo diet restaurant in Brixton. And I walked in and the wonderful lady is telling me everything that's on the menu. And I'm like, oh, that sounds wonderful, wonderful. And then I went, you do realise that the original paleo diet would have been eating every bit of the animal. So you'd be eating the eyes, you'd be eating the inside of the intestines, you'd be eating the hooves, you'd be eating everything. And it was just the funniest moment because this woman's like face was like, what on earth is happening? It was like a kind of hazing, but like a really intellectual academic kind of hazing. They cut it from the film. It's like, yeah, Ella hazing these poor paleo dieters is probably not worthy of a BBC Two series. And I think that's the issue. I think, so for me, I've got two issues with the paleo diet. One is that in the Paleolithic, you know, you didn't have the choice. You ate every bit of the animal. It was really, really important. And to be honest, the way that we live in the UK is so unique to even the way my grandmother would have lived in the UK just a few decades back. Because we're very, very lucky, some might call us spoilt, in the foods that we eat. Because we really do stick to certain cuts. Like, we just don't tend to you know, eat things that other people around the world would eat. Even our grandparents in this country would have eaten. I remember one ex, his family would cook hooves. And it was just like, you know, it was like a... And I was like, what? No. It's on the feet. Why would we eat that? And it's like, well, of course, people around the world, like once they killed an animal, they weren't about to throw bits out. They were going to eat every single bit of that animal. Like, it's wasteful. And so we're just... I think we see the rest of the world as weird, whereas actually, if you think about it from a historical perspective, we're the weird ones that we live in. And it's not... You don't even have to go that far. There's still parts of Europe where people are kind of, you know, eating what we would consider as quite exotic, you know. And so I think one of the things is, going back to your original question, eating every bit of the animal. And so until these Brixton and Hackney restaurants are actually serving up, you know, as I said, the insides of the intestines, it's not the paleo diet, I'm sorry. And the other thing is, guys, I get that the paleo diet may be of interest to people. But in the Paleolithic, you would be lucky if you lived to 30. So, help me out a little bit. I know I have to be nuanced about this, because I know that things like agriculture 10,000 years ago, once we had the kind of the agricultural revolution, you know, it has meant that now we only have a few strains of different kinds of grain, and that is bad for us, and there is evidence for that. But the thing is, there's always a trade-off, because if it wasn't for agriculture, we would not be able to live in cities. If we didn't live in cities, we wouldn't have iPhones, you know? And I know that sounds like, oh, girl, poor girl, she can't be on her Instagram. But actually, think of all the culture that we would not have Mozart. We would not have, you know, Picasso. We would not have all of these things if it wasn't for the fact that we have agriculture and we're able to now sustain much, much, much bigger populations. So I think one of the things that I constantly think is, I get some of the arguments that are put forward quite simplistically about like the paleo diet or paleo lifestyle. I get some elements of it, but I just don't think they're very nuanced, and we need to be more balanced. We need to say, yeah, you know, we're biologically not predisposed to only eat, you know, four different varieties of something, or 10 different varieties of, you know, two of which to own by, you know, a massive multinational. Yeah, probably that's, you know, that's not good for us. And yeah, it might be why allergies are on the rise, et cetera, et cetera. But the solution isn't for us to go back to the Neolithic or the Paleolithic. Like, there's, you know, that, because that lifestyle wasn't great either. So it's about how do we take on those really cool pop anthropology headlines, but kind of just be a bit more nuanced? I guess it's one of the fun things I had with the book, kind of trying to point out things that, yeah, it, just a bit more nuance in arguments. Because I think there is this fascination with the Paleolithic and, oh, what did our ancestors do? And it's like, yeah, that's useful.
Let's talk about your book. So the handshake is looking at the historical and biological basis of social physical contact. Now, we are currently, as we record this, in the third UK lockdown following the coronavirus.
Well done, everyone.
Are you a fortune teller? Have you bought a lottery ticket? At what point did you start to foresee how timely this book was going to be?
Yeah, I do have friends who apparently think I'm clairvoyant, and they're just like, wow, isn't it amazing, Ella, that you were writing a book on the handshake and then it got banned? And I'm just thinking, what is wrong with you people? this was a book that was actually thought of by my wonderful literary agent, Julian Alexander, because I had been shelved. I'm a TV presenter and explorer, and I'm on the road a lot. And obviously, you know, when COVID came about, rightfully so, I was benched. So essentially, you know, it was a case of my TV agent was just having a gossip, as best as I can tell, with my literary agent. And they were like, we should get Ella to write a book on the handshake, because, you know, she's an archaeologist, that'd be quite handy. And then when they said this to me, I couldn't stop laughing, because they were presenting it to me as, Ella, how do you feel about this? You don't have to, like, you know, just have a think about it, blah, blah, blah. And I started laughing, because I went, guys, I was brought up in a very, very strict Muslim tradition, where till the age of 26, I never shook a man's hand. Not really. Like, I probably shook maybe two or three. I have obsessed about this subject in intricate detail.
Because you would. And also, by the way, that Muslim background of mine was the dry run for social distancing. I've got this shit down. I will tell you what works, what doesn't work. I've been doing this for a very long time.
And it's just really, really wonderful, actually. And that's kind of how it came about. And it was quite interesting at the time because it was presented to me as, oh, you know, maybe it's time to write the obituary of the handshake. And I was like, no, we're writing the ode to the handshake, because I found myself so vehemently disagreeing with all the arguments that were being used in the press. Like, everyone from the New Yorker, New York Times, and possibly your own publications.
Highly likely.
Everyone, like, it just, suddenly there was this dead of, like, journalists being like, we hate it, it's the most disgusting thing in the world, touching palms. And I'm sitting there going, you lot. But also, it just felt so Anglo-Saxon, do you know what I mean? Like, oh, we have to touch palms. I'm like, I literally just came from a culture where I had to rub their noses and be quiet, right?
Do you think people were kind of, in a way, sort of delighted that the handshake had been banned, because it was, I mean, lots of people don't like shaking hands or kissing anyway here.
Certainly these journalists. I could just, in my head, there's probably only like 5 journalists, but they have been pitching this idea to their editors for the last like 5 years and no one's taking them seriously, and suddenly it's like, fine, Francesca, you can have it. and they went off. No, but it was just wonderful, because I'm sitting there going, well, hold on a second. I mean, and I cannot, I don't want to blow my own trumpet, but I was ready to take these arguments apart. I don't know if you guys are familiar with this, but there was 2 things that were happening a lot at the beginning of the first lockdown, or kind of as COVID was starting. One was people saying this was going to be the death of the handshake. We were never going to shake hands again. We were never going to hug again. And I'm talking about, you know, very, sometimes even heads of states of some countries were kind of saying this kind of thing. And I thought this was incredibly bad public health messaging. And it was not based in any fact, because in fact, in every single case of recorded history that we have seen an epidemic or a pandemic that has stopped the handshake, it has always come back again. And I can list examples. You know, there are, you know, the Spanish flu, there were multiple cases of the handshake kind of just stopping in numerous places. In fact, in Prescott, Arizona, they actually banned it outright. There was a yellow fever epidemic right at the beginning of the United States being the United States, in Philadelphia. Everyone just stopped shaking hands. In Baku, Azerbaijan, at the end of the 1800s, there was a cholera epidemic. They actually started an anti-handshake society where you paid a few rubles and wore a pin to identify yourself. And guess what? In 2020, as the pandemic spread, in Baku, Azerbaijan, in Philadelphia, in Prescott, Arizona, the handshake was back again for us to be like, guys, we think you need to stop it. So just this idea that it was going to, you know, kind of be banned forever was really bad, and it was catastrophizing, and it was kind of scaring people. And also, I don't know about you guys, but basic human psychology, if you tell people, that's it, we're done, we're never going to do it again, if you're, you know, most people actually want to touch people a little bit, you know, and it kind of either makes you feel really pessimistic about life, or you sit there and go, well, if I'm never going to be able to do it again, I'm going to do it, because, you know, what's the
rebelling,
point?
Isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Like, well, what's the point? Like, I don't want to live my life without hugging people. So I just thought it was really bad.
We fetishised the handshake.
Yeah, I know. Well, I do. I'm not the only one. I'm slightly concerned that when it comes back, I'm just going to be holding people's hands, like, through whole meetings. And people are going to be like, Ella, we're going to need to send you to human resources. just genuinely talk to you about things.
And do you think, obviously, handshake is one form of sort of way that we use our hands, but obviously we use it to eat, and you were talking earlier about the kind of Yemeni traditions. Do you think the pandemic's also changed the way that we kind of consume food?
So I think it has, in the sense that I think for a little bit, we might not be as keen on sharing. So I don't know about you guys, but I've definitely had cases where people that I would normally be 100% comfortable kind of sharing or having a bite of food with, you know, my sisters are, you couldn't get closer, really. And we're not doing it right now. So I think in that sense, but I think as with the handshake, it will come back. Like, there's no doubt in my mind that it will come back. And unless, with one exception, unless we enter into an era of pandemics, you know, imagine, God forbid, geez. But like the next 10 years. I know. There's like, you know, there's another 3 pandemics. I could see a scenario where people would be like, yeah, we're done. But if it's kind of as is, and there's no evidence for an era of pandemics, as far as I'm concerned, touch wood. But yeah, but I think, you know,
I think just kind of going back to kind of the kind of the fun stuff to think about with the handshake is that, you know, chimps shake hands. They actually shake feet as well sometimes. And it has a very similar meaning. Dr. Kat Hobater at St. Andrews has this whole study where she shows that it has a very similar meaning. In fact, sometimes when two chimps are kind of having a fight, sometimes they'll kind of sheepishly go up to each other afterwards and like shake hands. It's the cutest thing. It's like, let's make up, fine. It has exactly kind of the same meaning. And I think, you know, we should rest assured that it is terrible. The pandemic is absolutely dreadful. But hopefully life will go back to normal. And we should take a lot of comfort in that. And, you know, and it's also fun to just take things apart. So I think a lot of people were saying at the beginning of the pandemic, yes, the handshake comes from medieval times when we were trying to demonstrate that there was no weapon up your sleeve. And I was like, mate, that just surely provides access. Like, you know, like that doesn't make sense. And then I looked into it. And of course, like there's a US President McKinley who was actually assassinated by somebody pretending to go in for a handshake. And, you know, I mean, I argue throughout my book that the handshake is actually biological. It's not just cultural, that it's in our DNA. It's probably at least 7 million years old. And I have a lot of fun with looking at other cultures, actually, and the handshakes and the greetings that they have. Because actually ours is really demure. Like, you know, the handshake that we have is really demure. The Liberian finger snap is a wonderful handshake where at the end they snap fingers, and it's kind of the louder the snap, the more, I guess, the happier they are to see you. There's some greetings that have become extinct in the last 100 years, some of which, guys, are fantastic. There's a penis shake. There's a...
Wow.
I'm going to keep going.
That'd be hard one to get going.
and if you refuse that, it's like a declaration of war. I mean, I could go into it, but I don't know how graphic your podcast is. There's a breast suckle greeting that's actually not uncommon in some parts of the world. Well, was not uncommon in some parts of the world. My favourite version of that was where you had to take a wand suckle from the chief's wife's teat as a hello. It was quite exceptional. There's the bum salutation, which it was truly global, including, you know, kind of in German territories, in kind of Germany and Japan, all the way through to parts of Africa. And there's different variations of that. There's even a urine salutation, which doesn't seem like much of a greeting to me at all, but there we go. And I think it's kind of wonderful that all these kind of just truly, as far as I'm concerned, fantastic greetings once existed, but in the last 100 years, sadly, have kind of gone.
Maybe they'll come back.
Is that optimism on your side?
And obviously you've been, as everyone has, sort of stuck, obviously writing this book, but generally stuck. What have you been cooking during lockdown?
Mate, I have not been cooking. I eat a lot and I eat very well a lot of the time. But as I said, I had a reaction to having been domesticated and a housewife at the age of 21. Apparently it results in somebody refusing to cook. But one of the things that I don't know about other people, but I found I put on a lot of weight during, there was a moment where I looked at my weight and went, right, so that hasn't happened before. And so one of the things is I've been desperately trying to do salmon quite a lot recently, because I'm just like, you know, this is probably not the best thing in the world. But also just going back to basic salads. I know this sounds really basic, but just things like salads with apple vinegar. I kind of forgot about apple vinegar, apple cider vinegar. I mean, I say all this, I was in the Swiss Alps for 2 months and all I consumed was cheese. So cheese and fondue and all kinds of just, yeah, game. So yeah, that's probably actually what caused the weight gain in the first place, actually. Come to think of it.
And what's comfort food for you?
Everything. I know, honestly, absolutely. I just love food. And it is one of those things where I have conversations with myself where I think I have blamed it on the fact that I'm a curious person. So this is somebody who's desperately trying to justify their eating habits. I will turn up to, as I said, you know, I'm incredibly, incredibly lucky that I would normally get to turn up to all these countries and see all this different kind of cuisine. And one of the things that always stressed me out was sometimes I'm only there for a few hours, right? And I'm like, but I need to try everything. And so I would. And so not only would my bank balance be in like desperate shock, but so would my stomach, because it'd be like, mate, you need to stop. Just take one thing. But the problem is when you go somewhere and you know, so, and I think this is just me generally. So if I walk in, when the bakeries reopened, you know, there was a few weeks there when the bakeries all closed. So when they reopened, quite a few of them were stocked with new cakes. And I was like, we're going to try all of it on the same day. And it's like, I think one of my things is, it's it's just trying everything is, and that's a kind of a problem. And I really wish it wasn't, you know, such a need. And sometimes I just think, if you just give me two bites of everything, I'd be happy. But obviously you have to buy the whole thing. I recently had, I didn't actually realize that it existed, but a Yemeni Israeli restaurant nearby. And the food there was exceptional. So I don't know if people realize the history of Jews in Yemen. It was absolutely kind of spectacular, amazing, and very depressing history. But the cuisine is really interesting because it's because they are Yemeni, but it's got a little bit of an edge to it. And you know, the falafel are made, they're a bit greener, and you know, everything's kind of just really yummy. And so yeah, so I had a wonderful kind of which felt like home, really, kind of falafel, aubergine kind of wrap with tahini, and just kind of lay on the bed just being like, oh.
And Ella, we normally end this podcast with a question about a desert island meal. Normally a desert island probably seems quite a remote concept to our guests, but actually for you maybe isn't perhaps so remote. What would be your desert island meal?
I'm going to be so boring. I'm like, practical calories, get them in good boxes. And if I can ideally have it sponsored so I can put it on Instagram. That was way too honest an answer. Okay, so obviously the explorer just thinks calories and, you know, how to get calories and all the rest of it. But if it wasn't that, and if it was, I think, in the spirit in which you mean it, I think it would be maqlouba, which is a northern Arab dish, kind of. It's more like Lebanon, Syria, Palestine and Egypt, that area. And it is a spectacular dish. It is lamb that is cooked for about 6 to 7 hours, very slowly. Then you get rice, and you basically get lamb, you put it at the bottom, the cooked lamb, you put it at the bottom of the dish. You get aubergines, you put them there as well. Then you get the rice, you put it on top, you add the broth, and you cook that for an additional 4 hours. And then you get the whole thing and you turn it upside down. Maqlouba literally means upside down. And so you're looking at a bed of rice at the bottom with lamb on top, with aubergine on top of that. And then you should really kind of get some nuts and raisins and kind of fry them, sesame seeds, put them on top with the yogurt. And I just want to go home.
That sounds so good.
Go eat that. It is a full day's work, though. So it's a real surprise that I haven't cooked that in easily 4 years.
Ella, thank you for joining Table Talk. And Ella's new book, The Handshake, is available now.
Thank you for joining us on The Spectator's Food and Drink podcast. For more recipes, food history, stories and drinks, you can head to The Spectator website. La pauvre fleur disait au papillon céleste, ne fuis pas.